Ryan looked back down the shoulder of the gray-green mountain. The little line of people and animals crawled up the trail after him. The fourth day of their journey gathered toward the climax of a spectacular western sunset. The treeless slope ahead of them went up to a hogback ridge. Against the blazing glory of fusing colors that fired the sky, Joe and his pony loomed like statues graven from granite. Ryan was in a good mood, the best he had been in for longer than he cared to remember. He found keen pleasure in exploring new lands, and he found trekking through the wilderness very congenial. Other than his friends, he hadn't seen another human being in 2 days, and the animals crossing his field of vision appeared normal, not mutated. Their provisions had held out, and the grass growing in the valleys was thick and rich enough to provide proper graze for the horses and mules. Even the injuries he had suffered in Amicus, from the laceration on his forehead to the wolf bite on his arm, were almost completely healed. As Ryan rode toward the ridge, he saw Joe suddenly stiffen and point. He gestured to Ryan and the people below to increase their pace.
Now what? Has he sighted his valley yet? He should have. This is the fourth day.
No. Something's wrong. They reached Joe at the very crest of the ridge. From there, they looked northward toward another and parallel mountain range. Its highest, most northern peaks were snow-capped, and beyond them was a stupendous vista of other smaller ranges, probably extending into Canada. A deep, thick, wooded gully yawned between the crest on which they stood and another rocky rampart. The tall trees were fir and pine and poplar, and the ground was carpeted with high grass. Joe's jet-black eyes gleamed with fear.
Your rifle! Shoot them quickly!
Ryan followed Joe's pointing finger to the gully below. At first he saw nothing, but then he spotted two dark shapes skulking through a glade.
You mean the wolves?
Yes, you must kill them or our danger is great.
Ryan drew the Steyr from its saddle scabbard and shouldered it, peering through the scope. Despite the dimming light, the laser image enhancer brought the animals into sharp focus. The nearer wolf was close to the 600-yard range. Ryan centered the crosshairs on the furry skull, wondering about Lakota superstitions. From what Mose Autry had said about Amerindian beliefs, wolves were respected to the point of reverence. Joe's fearful demand that they be killed made no sense, regardless of his enmity with the Wolf Soldier Society.
Wait, why do you want them chilled? They're too far away to bother us.
They'll take word of our coming to Tirawa. Hurry, Ochinae!
Ryan's finger tensed on the Steyr's trigger. The skull of the wolf was framed perfectly for a lethal headshot. Suddenly, the animal glanced up. There was a swift flash of intelligence, of understanding in the green-gold eyes. In those eyes, Ryan saw no malice, and moreover, he recognized them. On impulse, Ryan shifted the rifle's position a fraction of an inch. A plume of dirt spouted between the wolf's forepaws. Both animals sprang backward and raced into the dappled shadows between the trees.
You deliberately missed!
Now they'll what? What can wolves do but act like wolves?
Ryan didn't add that he suspected the wolf named Bloodsniffer had spared his life in Amicus, a decidedly unlupine act. Joe didn't answer. His fierce obsidian eye swept over the figures of Jack, Doc, Mildred, and Christy, and the two pack mules as they topped the crest of the ridge.
We can't camp anywhere near here now. We must keep moving through the night, and moving fast. The soldiers will be out to cut us off now that their scouts have taken back word of our arrival.
No. We're not moving at all until we hear some explanations.
All will be made clear when we reach Tirawa.
You've been saying that for days. You'll fucking well make it clear here and now. It seems like you want us to get involved in something more than an intertribal conflict about high laws and low laws. Straight tongue, or we'll backtrack out of here.
You're forgetting about the gold, aren't you?
Don't think we're so greedy you have us where you want us. Curiosity drove us most of the way. You need us worse than we need you. Talk, or we ride out.
Joe eyed the six people, his mind obviously gauging and weighing Ryan's threat. Then, he shrugged.
There is no time to tell you everything. We must move fast or we die.
Then why don't you talk fast?
I've told you about the two factions, the Wolf Soldiers and the Cavern Keepers. My faction believes in healing the Grandmother Earth so that all men and women may benefit from the restored Earth energies. But Peasy, Shishoka, and the Wolf Soldiers aspire to keep the planet the way it is so the entire world will always be a Deathlands. The Earth will never recover from the nuking, and it will continue to be a nightmare.
Shit. Sound like a jolt head.
Yeah, maybe so, maybe not so. The gold is real enough.
So it is.
But what has it to do with tribal superstitions?
I knew you would doubt me. That was why I dared not tell you the truth.
Magic Tiratwa. Life, death, good, evil, joy, and sorrow. All born in the cavern of creation.
Bullshit. This is all bullshit. But we can spread it out thin later. Right now, I want to know what kind of danger we're talking about. How far are we now from Tiratwa?
Joe gestured to the craggy cliffs on the far side of the wooded gully.
The valley lies on the other side of those cliffs, but reaching it will be extremely tricky now.
Why?
There is only one entrance into the valley. It leads near the lair of the wolf soldiers, yet we must pass through it to reach my people. If the wolves get back word of us, they'll block us at the pass.
Wolves? Do wolves tell on us?
The beasts of Tiratwa are not the beasts of the white man's world. They are intelligent. Some as intelligent as men. That is why we must hurry.
Ryan and his five friends grasped at least the urgency of the situation. They had, all of them, fought too many battles and made too many forced marches through dangerous territory not to understand the need for stealth and strategy.
Let's do as Joe says. He's either a liar, a lunatic, or a superstitious stoop. We'll find out which later. Right now I smell trouble.
Joe's face was tight with anger at Ryan's words, but he said nothing as he jerked his pony's head toward the path to the gully below. The sun continued to sink, and darkness came with an unwelcome rush as Joe led the little caravan down into the heavily treed gorge. They made their way through the tangle of fir, pine, and poplar. Joe knew the trails. He turned southward, and the companions turned after him, their horses stumbling on loose turf and stones. Only Judas Redux tramped on without mistake. Ryan had a sudden and claustrophobic awareness of the huge mountain ranges that boxed them into this wild pocket of the world, and he thought of how the Red Cadre had been trapped in a gorge.
Faster! We must go faster!
Joe, are we running because of the wolf cry, or is there something else?
That is it! Everybody stop!
What's going on?
They've pinpointed our position. They're coming.
Blasters primed and loaded, everybody! Triple red!
Joe reached beneath his fringed deerskin cape. Ryan assumed he was pulling out a weapon, but in his hand was the wafer of gold with the two crystal discs mounted on either side of it.
What are you doing?
Quiet. I need to concentrate.
Joe pressed the wafer of metal to his forehead. The crystals caught the glow of the rising moon in the frosty starlight, and the facets seemed to sparkle. Ryan felt stunned wonder, and a swelling fear that the Lakota had suddenly and completely lost his mind.
What is it? What's he doing?
More Jotehead shit. We can't stand here all night. Go, leave him.
Wait, Jack. Joe seems to know what he's doing.
Joe suddenly wheeled toward Ryan, lowering the golden slice of metal from his forehead.
A force of wolf soldiers is on its way to cut us off inside the pass. My warriors can't reach us in time to help.
How did you come by that tidbit of knowledge?
We must get through the pass and into Tiratwa before we're encircled.
What kind of opposition can we expect? How many men?
Perhaps not so many men, but they have many warriors.
More crazy talk.
They may use trained wolves as fighters, like the one that was set on me and Amicus. Damn messy if they catch us in a narrow pass. Let's get moving. Whatever's waiting for us, we'll be better off meeting it in the valley than down here or in the pass.
Joe led them up a trail that twisted among giant boulders and gaunt fir trees. As they climbed out of the gully, the moonlight allowed them a glimpse of a crack splitting the stone rampart, towering above and ahead of them. A pulse-quickening sense of danger filled Ryan as he urged his horse upward along the rock-littered trail. They came up clear of the last trees and onto naked granite shelves and ledges. The lofty rampart loomed before them. The pass was a narrow crack, barely 20 feet wide, shaped like a lopsided upside-down triangle. It wasn't long, barely an eighth of a mile, and ran a fairly straight course. They emerged onto a wide shelf-like ledge, splashed with moonlight. Joe gestured with a sweeping wave of one arm.
Tiratwa!
It's beautiful!
Ryan found himself looking down on a place he had never visited, yet had always known in his dreams. He sat in the saddle and stared, not moving, not thinking, not blinking, not even breathing. He looked upon a land magically silvered by the moon and the shining, wheeling constellations overhead. It was a bowl-shaped valley, at least 20 miles in diameter, completely and protectively enclosed by towering ranges that rose up towards stupendous snow-crowned peaks. The valley was a breathtaking vista of green pastures, forests, ponds, lakes, and a river. It smelled clean and fresh, untainted by blood or greed or anger. For a moment, Ryan felt dizzy. His skin tingled, his heart raced.
Joe, where's the encampment of your people?
Southwest, toward the forest, that way.
Straining his eye, Ryan discerned shapes and light, a collection of dimly glimmering structures, strangely interconnected with the surrounding tree line. Though he could pick out no details, it looked like no Indian village he had ever seen.
The lair of the wolf soldiers is there, to the northwest.
Ryan followed Joe's pointing hand. The river that flowed across the valley, the loops reflecting the moon, bent toward a little cluster of flickering lights on the far side. Beyond those dancing pinpoints of fire, seemingly against the foothills of the upthrusting ramparts, was another light. It shimmered, seemed to vibrate, a vague, unreal, green-yellow glow.
They're signaling to the other warriors. We must ride like the wind.
Pack mules can't ride like the wind, Joe.
Then leave them. Hyah!
Following Joe, the six companions rode pell-mell down the rocky slopes, the horses' hooves triggering miniature avalanches of loose shale. The forest came up to meet them, and they galloped between tree trunks, ducking limbs and slapping branches aside. The horse beneath Ryan ran with all its strength in a stretch-legged, thundering stride. Ryan glimpsed dark blurs sliding among the trees, only momentarily visible through the tangle of foliage and underbrush. Suddenly, they emerged from the forest and galloped across a rolling, grassy sward. Far ahead were a few closely grouped flickering lights. Joe directed his pony toward them. Then they were lost from view as the party raced down into a declivity of the plain. The wolves loped and bounded across the valley to encircle the fleeing humans and horses. Ryan leaned over his animal's neck, its mane smacking his face.
Everybody stop! I'll saddle before they pull us down! Make a stand here!
Ryan slid from his saddle, trying to hold the reins of his terrified horse. A black, hairy bolt rushed from the murk, and he brought his stire up. The wolf loped away on three legs. Christy, Jack, JB, and Mildred formed a rough circle around Ryan, standing back to back, guns at the ready.
Where's Doc?
Just when I was reconsidering rechristening that monster, he has to live up to his name. I am more startled than wounded.
Look, it's not just wolves.
Painted men upon horseback, wearing wolfskin cloaks and hoods, wielding feathered lances and tomahawks, pounded across the plain like a wave.
Shoot to kill!
Shield a man! Wolves run away if we shoot to masters!
Ryan knew, without really knowing how he knew, that Jack was mistaken. The wolves displayed independent tactical thinking. They showed it by the way they came on in irregular zigzag bounds to minimize the chances of falling victim to weapons that were obviously new and fearsome to them. For a long moment, it was all crazy confusion, with everyone firing in random patterns. Then the veterans of hundreds of fights for survival tightened into a well-oiled gestalt of destruction. Ryan and his friends chose their targets coolly and squeezed off careful shots, oblivious to the racket their attackers were deliberately making.
Keep shooting!
Though flights of arrows and the occasional lance zipped their way, a steady storm of lead exploding from handguns broke full on their human and beast enemies. The charge of wolves and horsemen wavered, then broke. The attackers retreated in the face of the deadly and accurate barrage.
Hold your fire! Is everybody okay?
I'm fine.
I think we've all made it, lover.
Can't say the same for them, though.
At least a dozen bodies, man and animal, dotted the plain. Something in the shadows attracted Joe's attention, and he moved toward it quickly. Ryan followed him and saw the Lakota approaching a crouching wolf. The fur of its right haunch was matted with blood, and its leg was obviously injured. The beast turned its face toward them. It continued to crouch, glaring from Joe to Ryan, as if trying to decide which human presented the greater threat. With a start, Ryan recognized the wolf as Shishoka's friend, the one she had called Bloodsniffer, and automatically he raised his 6-hour. The gold-green eyes flamed into his, and Ryan hesitated before squeezing the trigger. Suddenly, the wolf sprang directly for Ryan's throat.
Joe slammed the wolf down with his rifle butt.
What the hell, guys? Why didn't you just shoot the fucking thing?
Joe smiled, a thin slash of triumph across his high-planed face.
He's far more valuable to us alive.
Ryan and his friends looked around in silence at the carnage of corpses. All the bullet-blasted bodies somehow seemed blasphemous in this valley. Joe lifted his rifle over his head and turned his face to the moon.
We have a prisoner! And we have given our enemies their first taste of our new weapons and warriors!
Christy came to Ryan's side. The Smith & Wesson trembled in her hand. She looked more shaken than he had ever seen her. She stared at the dead animals lying on the moon-washed sward, her sentient hair coiled tight against her nape.
Ryan, Joe was right. These wolves are intelligent. This is wrong.
Everyone reload!
Ryan glanced down at the senseless wolf, completely at a loss as to why Joe would want to make an animal, no matter how well-trained or intelligent, a hostage. Christy was right. This was wrong. In an intangible fashion, he couldn't easily identify. The battle wasn't like the conflict with the Red Cadre, or so many others over the years. He couldn't shake the shameful sensation that he and his friends had invaded the Promised Land, a new Eden, their weapons enacting the role of serpents.
We must go on, and quickly. More of the wolf soldiers will be here.
Kneeling, Joe lashed rawhide thongs around the fore and hind paws of the unconscious wolf. He muzzled the beast, securing its jaws tightly. As he tightened the knot, the wolf stirred slowly, its eyes opening. They blazed with fear, then with such a potent rage that Ryan felt his belly turn a cold flip-flop.
Shit. More riders.
Wait. They are my people.
Illumined by the white disk of the moon, a band of horsemen galloped toward them from the distant flickering firelight. The half-dozen men wore buckskin leggings, and like the wolf soldiers, were armed with lances, bows, and arrows. A burly man slid from his steed and strode toward Joe. They clasped forearms. Ryan recognized the man as Little Mountain. Joe gestured for the others to step forward.
This is Little Mountain, who brought me word of your arrival in Amicus. He will escort us to the village. We must hurry. The wolf soldiers are massing for another attack.
Doc's eyes were disconcerted as he gazed at the bound wolf.
Lufgaru.
Jack, who knew the legends of the Cajun people, was startled.
Man to change the wolves? Shit. That old story for old stoops, Doc. Surprised at you.
Everybody, mount up!
Bloodsniffer was slung across Little Mountain's pony and tied to the saddle with thongs. As they trotted across the rolling sward, Ryan knew there was no way he could reconcile the Valley of Tirawa with the rest of Deathlands. This hidden pocket of Earth had existed long before the nuking and Skydark, its people living an ancient way of life, unaffected by the outside world. Or perhaps not. The old ways seemed to be moving toward a climax of conflict as a direct result of the presence of him and his friends. They had brought Deathlands to the valley. The party rode down a gentle slope toward a collection of structures near the banks of the valley's timber-bordered river. Ryan had expected teepees or bark lodges, but what he saw was so dumbfounding, he suspected hallucination. The village was built into the forest, in some ways a part of the forest. Massive hollow tree trunks served as lodgings. Giant boughs were like arboreal footpaths, and low-hanging branches were so intertwined that they formed roofs and shelters. Light shone from within many of the trees, through windows that didn't look cut, but formed out of the living wood. Here and there, supported by frameworks and lattices of branches and limbs, were crystal discs, giant duplicates of the one on Joe's golden wafer. They shimmered and glittered, reflecting the firelight. The interlocking facets gleamed with multicolored sparks, like prismatic pieces of a rainbow cut from the sky.
My God, this place! It's like it doesn't belong on Earth at all!
Following Joe's lead, they rode through the crystalline forest-entwined village. There was little underbrush. The great trunks loomed like the pillars of ancient temples that Ryan had seen pictures of in books. The moonlight, what little of it, pierced the multi-level overhead tangle of branch, limbs, and leaves, was tinted green, as if they were underwater. Ryan suspected that the tree city was inestimably old, far older than recorded human history. It looked as if the forest had grown around the crystal discs.
The settlement didn't appear to have been built solely for human use. As it was, few people were in the forest ways. The community seemed too big for the number of people he saw. Joe led the way toward a complex of structures made of a wide belt of gigantically trunked trees. The huge limbs were intertwined like wooden fingers, connecting one tree to the other. A canopy of leaves and branches formed a vast roof that blotted out the star and moonlit sky. Little Mountain, with the captive wolf, went around the center tree.
We need not talk to the other chiefs until morning. All of you must be tired.
Where do we sleep?
I will show you. Your weapons must remain with me.
No need.
I can assure you they will be well guarded.
Yeah, they will. By us.
Joe and Ryan locked stares for a long moment. The warriors looked back and forth from their chief to the one-eyed outlander.
It's for the best, Joe. In unskilled hands, our weapons will be dangerous to the people they're supposed to defend.
Joe considered the response for a second, then shrugged and walked through the archway into the tree. The doorway behind the hanging pelt was like that of a cathedral, and the interior was broad and empty. Light flickered from torches of resinous wood, flaming in crude sockets that looked like knotholes. The room was furnished with wooden chairs and bed frames piled high with soft furs. The workmanship was passable and utilitarian. The room had only one window, covered by the pelt of some small animal.
Food will be brought to you shortly. Tomorrow, after you're rested, we will talk.
Yeah, about many things.
Joe's eyes narrowed, but he nodded.
Many things indeed.
He's too goddamn cagey. He's got a joker in his pack.
And we've got to find an ace in the line to play against him.
You know, I've never received impressions like this before.
How do you mean?
It's a jumbled mixture of human and animal emotions. The animal emotions, though, are strange. Generally, their feelings are simple. Fear, hunger, curiosity. What I detected from the wolves was stronger. Very pure and clean. The animals here might not be as intelligent as humans, but their emotional reactions are similar in intensity.
The conversation came to an abrupt halt when a young, slim woman entered. Not even the shapeless doeskin smock and fringed mantle she wore disguised the full-breasted figure swelling beneath it. Ryan had always thought Indian women were supposed to be shy, but she gave Jack a speculative stare with dark, bold eyes. She placed a wicker tray of food platters on the table, and as she left, she strode by Jack, her hips swinging in an inviting fashion. Jack chose to ignore her, reaching for one of the plates of food. The bowls were filled with a boiled stew of venison and vegetables, and the jars contained some kind of fermented fruit juice. It tasted something like cider, but it possessed a mild alcoholic kick. The stew was rich, thick, and delicious, though the meat had a faint, grassy undertaste.
Hey, what was that business Joe pulled with a gold piece?
Some sort of psionic accelerator, maybe. Crystals and precious metals, particularly heavy ones like silver, gold, and platinum, are believed to be conductors of psychic energy.
Yeah, I remember that vogue. Used to be called the New Age. Crystals and certain metals supposedly enhanced your spiritual awareness, purified your auras, drained off negative energy, and a fortune from the gullible. It all sounds like far-out man mumbo-jumbo to me.
Maybe it does to you, and maybe it truly was in your day. But the fact remains that some Indian tribes discovered long ago how to interchange energy with certain kinds of crystals, thought pattern energy included. Mother Sonia once told me crystals were used for sending and receiving telepathic messages. But because people lost the art, the discipline, the majority of the communications degenerated into three-dimensional visions in a manner that became known as fortune-telling. In fact, my mother could far see with a crystal. She called it scrying.
Also called bullshit.
Ryan almost envied Jack's single-mindedness. The mystery of the valley and even of the strange forest city hadn't disturbed Jack at all. Lack of fear served him well.
So are we dealing with a lost tribe of Indians here?
A lost band, maybe, but not a tribe. They're Sioux and they speak Lakota. But it's weird, I'll give you that. Hopefully we'll learn more.
Hopefully before the other shoe drops.
Hey, up and at 'em, lover. It's morning. You have any dreams last night?
No. I haven't for a while.
I guess that's good. The others were all waking, sitting up, rubbing bleared eyes, looking around. The same girl as before brought them food, placed it on the table, and silently left. Breakfast was the same simple fare as supper, but instead of fruit juice, the jars contained a strong yet stimulating tea, probably boiled from bark. It was more palatable than the similar tea in Amicus. As they finished eating, the burly little mountain came in and gestured curtly.
Follow.
Where's Joe?
Follow!
Obviously, Joe had taught him only that one English word to speak to the outlanders. The six people made sure their weapons were primed and loaded and walked out of the room after the big-shouldered warrior. They went through a curving wooden corridor that opened up on a small room. The chamber's walls were lined with clusters of crystal formations. Light swirled, sparkled, and danced from the countless points and facets. The shades of color were variegated, shifting from light blue to a deeper amethyst to purplish tints. Ryan was impressed by the chamber's beauty, but he was surprised to see that the mineral clusters conformed perfectly to the circular dimensions of the room, as if they had been grown by design. In the center of the chamber, secured by a heavy, braided length of rawhide affixed to a wooden staple in the floor, crouched Bloodsniffer. Joe stood in front of the wolf, glaring down at the imprisoned beast. In one hand, he held the wafer of gold, pressing it to his forehead.
Guess he talking wolf.
Actually, that is exactly what I'm doing. You outlanders have much to learn about the ways of Tiratwa.
That is quite the understatement. Perhaps you'll be so good as to educate us.
During the early epochs of my culture, the vast caverns wherein crystals grew were adapted as healing and communication chambers. Our forefathers knew how to tap the energy within them. When combined with gold or silver, my people learned the art of sending telepathic messages using the Yin Yang Wakang, the holy stones, as receivers. Last night, you all saw me call to Little Mountain for help. He stood in this room and was able to receive my thoughts at a distance.
You can read minds with your little doodads?
No. These senders were created by the first people who taught our forefathers to use them to communicate one mind to another, not to use them to invade another's mind. Individual thoughts cannot be detected unless the mind is consciously prepared to receive or to send.
Uh-huh.
Here, this will help you understand. Each of you, walk to a crystal point in this room and touch it with your hand.
Tentatively, they followed his instructions, hands pressed to the crystals. The mineral structure was warm, not cool as Ryan had expected it. He experienced a not unpleasant pins and needles tingling that spread up his fingers, along his arm, and then flowed all over his body.
Can you hear me, Ryan?
Yeah.
Good. Did you notice that I didn't open my mouth?
Dark night.
Joe was pressing the metal rectangle against his forehead and smiling a cold, superior smile.
You got those things from your forefathers?
We shall talk later of it. Now, I want you to speak to our prisoner.
Ryan glanced at the wolf. It met his gaze with a quizzical tilt of the head.
Nice doggy.
Not like that. Touch the crystal point as before.
Ryan did so, mentally focusing on the wolf. The image of a fanged, pointy-eared face materialized in his mind.
Tell him about your blasters, about their power to slay.
In his mind, the image of the wolf's eyes flashed a blazing green-gold fire, bright and beautiful, but almost painful to look upon. Involuntarily, Ryan closed his eye.
I know about your weapons, Outlander. They are the reason Shishoka bade me to slay you.
Why didn't you?
Instincts. I trust them, so should you.
Why are you a prisoner?
To make a bargain, such as the bargain touch the sky made with you and your ignorant outland friends.
What do you mean?
You have been promised a reward touch the sky cannot give.
Silence!
What the hell? Joe, what's it mean you can't give what you promised?
Joe lowered the wafer and stared venomously at the wolf. The creature's tongue lolled from between open jaws, as if it were enjoying the punchline to a joke.
He lies. I'll have him removed.
Like hell. Ryan tightened his hand on the crystal point. What do you mean?
Touch the Sky promised you the yellow metal.
Yes. Is there none?
There is much of it. Tiratwa has gold in abundance, but you cannot reach it.
Why?
It is in the sacred power place.
And where is that?
Enough!
Explain.
You will not understand.
Explain!
You are only a shadow of the real world, and your life here means little. But the places and things of power must be preserved for the sake of Grandmother Earth. Many medicine spots were defiled during the purification. You do not understand that if these things and places of power are destroyed, the life circle will be broken and thus destroy the process of life itself.
What are you talking about?
The cavern of creation, which nurtures a spark of the first circle. It is the place from whence all life sprang long, long ago.
Why can't we reach it?
It is death for any human who has not been purified. You, with your blasters and your greed, believe you can invade that holy place and steal away its wealth.
We didn't come here to steal.
The cavern is guarded by my brotherhood. Their lives are sworn to our grandmother. You cannot hope to slay them all before you are slain.
We didn't come here to steal.
I know why you came. You have been deceived, Outlander. I am sorry for you.
Joe, is this true?
It is true. The gold is in the cavern, at the far end of the valley.
You said it was here.
I said it was in the valley. That is the truth. When the wolf soldiers are conquered and we control the cavern, you will have your weight in it.
Double cross.
The Lakota glared at Jack, fearlessly.
How is it a double cross? Unless you planned to deceive me and take your reward before fulfilling your end of the bargain.
Ryan felt a grudging admiration for Joe's cleverness, obviously mistrusting their motives. He had set up a method to fight his fight before they could even glimpse the gold.
Bullshit! We heard nothing but bullshit since we come with you!
Take it easy, Jack. If the stuff is here, we can get it after the job is done.
The wolf lifted a paw toward Ryan.
Ignore him.
Ryan ignored Joe instead. He pressed his hand against the crystal point and opened his mind.
Touch the sky lies, One Eye. Not only does my brotherhood bar the way to the cavern, but inside dwell the ghosts of the first people, which not even your weapons can harm.
What do you mean?
Do not listen! Little Mountain!
Little Mountain stepped into the chamber and looped another braided leather leash around Bloodsniffer's throat. Then, with the warrior pricking its wounded leg with a lance point, the creature allowed itself to be led, limping from the room. It cast one backward glance toward Ryan. Ryan brought one hand to the butt of his Sig Sauer.
Time for straight tongue between us, Joe. You got us here, and now we need all the facts before we do anything else.
You shall have the facts. But I had to prove some of them first and open your minds to other possibilities.
Oh, you've certainly accomplished that, my lad.
How can these animals be so intelligent? It makes no scientific sense.
There is more to existence than white man's science. It was science that destroyed your world. The laws your people imposed on the world are gone, and the old ones have returned. Come, let us go back to your quarters. There I will tell you all.
Once they had returned, Joe remained standing as the others seated themselves.
Now, I'll start from the beginning, the very beginning. The story of this valley's origins, and in some ways, the origins of my people.
Ryan repressed a wry smile. If he was certain of one fact about Indians, it was that they loved to tell stories as much as the most long-winded, full-of-himself baron loved to talk.
In the beginning, the first people lived in a world without light or substance. They were a queer folk, part animal, part human, part air, and part mineral. They fought so much among themselves in their dark, formless world that Abadatea, he who made all things, took pity on them. He decided to create a new world for them, one with light and warmth and sensation, substance. So Abadatea formed this planet from celestial mud, imbued it with the essence of his sister, Grandmother Earth, and reshaped the first people so they could live upon it. Some of them became rocks, some became trees, some became bears and wolves and buffalo, and some, he sculpted into the form such as present man, though they were gigantic in stature. Then he released them from their dark world, and they emerged into this one from a cavern, here in the valley of Tirawa. In gratitude for their freedom and their great gift, the reshaped First People swore to Abadatea that they would always protect his sister. To always remind them of their vow, he placed a tiny piece of the stuff of creation in the cavern, the womb of Grandmother Earth, and charged the First People with keeping it safe throughout the four circles of existence until the time of purification. The First People kept this vow and evolved further and learned to live gracefully within the circles, though they eventually diverged from one another and spread out across the face of Grandmother Earth and formed separate tribes. They were all of the same matter, spawned in the cavern of creation. But always, a small group remained here in Tirawa, living the ancient ways in accordance with the high laws, fulfilling the promise to Abadatea. All the many and diverse manifestations of nature lived in harmony here. The beasts and the humans, the rocks and the trees, the earth and the water. The First People built this forest city, and their thoughts became audible through the crystals taken from the cavern. They channeled the power of Grandmother Earth to create, to heal, to communicate. It was truly a paradise, a land of happiness. The greatest warrior of the First People was the founder of the Holy Cavern Keeper Society. His name was Nanaboso, and when wounded in battle, he retreated deep into the Cavern of Creation to watch over the heart of the Grandmother in a kind of waking death. It was believed his spirit still dwelt there. Over the course of the centuries, tales of the valley seeped into the outer world. It was known as Quivira, Cibola, El Dorado. The greedy conquistadors and the white prospectors envisioned Tirawa as having silver spires, gold-paved streets, jade chairs, diamond drinking vessels. Many were the attempts to locate and invade the valley, and none was successful. Of all who had lived there, all were descendants of the First People, those who were spawned there. They kept the ancient vow to protect the valley and the cavern of creation with their lives. Tirawa was timeless. It existed unchanged and unchanging to that very day, perhaps to the very end of time. That is Tirawa's virtue and its curse.
Were you born here?
No, but the legend of its existence figured prominently in the lore of my people. When I came of age, I wandered the length and breadth of my ancestral lands in search of clues to its whereabouts. I spent many years and suffered much. A few years ago, I found this valley. I also found that the reality fell somewhere short of the legend, but in some instances exceeded it.
Give us an instance.
Our forefathers apparently lived here with a great and vast knowledge of how to manipulate natural earth energies. This city is the most obvious example. Most of that knowledge was lost over the centuries, except for a few relics like this. The ability to communicate with the higher animals in this valley still exists, but now it is limited to the wolves. Somehow the animals here developed a human-level intelligence.
Maybe due to a long-forgotten technique of bioengineering. As fantastic as it seems, it's the only possible explanation. It may also serve as the basis for the belief in animism, shared by most Native American tribes.
And what?
Animism. It's the belief that every living thing is connected on a spiritual level, that even animals and trees have souls. It's generally regarded as a primitive religious belief, mainly because it maintains that people, objects, and even the heavens are imbued with a consciousness, self-aware and interactive with the larger material reality. If what Joe says has any foundation in truth, it's probable that his forefathers took the tenets of animism to their highest possible expression and developed a way, possibly due to deliberately inducing mutations, to raise the intelligence level of animals.
Interesting theory. Whatever the explanation, the fact remains that in this valley, wolves are in many ways the equals of humans. At one time, bears, cougars, and even horses shared those traits. For some reason, only the intelligent wolves remain. At any rate, the prevailing belief in Tirawa is that all life forms were created at the dawn of time, spawned as equals from the cavern of creation. Animals were put on Earth to teach men valuable lessons. And since all living things have a common creator, all animals are our relatives, our brothers.
And this cavern is the storehouse for the gold.
Side tunnels contain metal relics, but the primary cave has never been entered. At least not in recent historical times. There are supposedly great dangers, not just to the body, but to the soul. Only the hereditary guardian of the cavern keepers knows how to enter it safely. For many centuries, it was a rite of passage for new guardians to enter the cave and give Nanaboso gifts, articles taken from those who tried to invade the valley and defile the grandmother. That practice ended a very long time ago.
Nanaboso, isn't that the name of the Algonquin trickster and cultural hero?
I believe so. Myth is woven so tightly around the cavern, it's almost impossible to untangle truth from legend. The primal energy of creation is believed to still pulse deep within the heart of the cavern, and the guardian is the warden of the vast powers.
And who is the current holder of that title?
That is the cause of this conflict, Ochinae. The last guardian was a shaman named Towashi. I was his student. He had no son, so I proved myself worthy of his mantle by going out into the world and destroying all the remains of the pre-dark evil. I was on that path when you met me. When I returned to Tirawa, I learned that Towashi had died, without officially passing on his knowledge or title.
You said he had no son. He had no other children?
One. You met her, Ochine, that night in Amicus.
Shishoka?
Yes. She has no more knowledge of how to enter the cavern safely and manipulate the energies there than I, but she claims the title. Over a period of months, the people of Tirawa broke into factions. The Brotherhood of Cavern Keepers, of which I am a ranking chief, seized this, the main village. Shishoka organized our military, the Wolf Soldiers, and settled some miles from here around the entrance to the cave.
Ryan shook his head. The story of Tirawa seemed too incredible to believe, almost like stories he had read in books as a child back at Front Royal. A long hidden valley holding the relics of an ancient civilization in North America. A valley from which all native peoples, all life itself, had sprung. A valley where wild beasts were on the same footing as humankind.
Surely there is more to this conflict than a mere disagreement over who is the rightful heir to a largely meaningless title.
Meaningless? Perhaps it seems so to you, but whoever holds the title of guardian holds the future of the world.
I don't understand.
The energies pent up in the cavern are the same as that which were released at the moment of creation, when this planet, perhaps the entire universe, exploded into existence. My ancestors tended to these energies, worshipped them, knew how to manipulate them to various degrees. You've seen the evidence of that, and the use of these energies helped Tirawa stay hidden for so many centuries. I and my brotherhood wish to manipulate those same energies again, to use them as they were used eons ago, to reshape, to remold, to heal the Earth.
Wait, reshape?
The world is an abomination, populated with unnatural monsters and spiritually dark people. The waters are poisoned, the sky full of deadly gases and radiation. All that can be reversed. Shishoka and her faction say my dream is only a power-mad ambition, that I am tampering with the natural order. I say the natural order has already been tampered with. It's been turned upside down, and it must be set right. The future of Grandmother Earth is at stake here. The future of humanity itself. Can we turn our backs on Grandmother Earth without turning our backs on the high laws themselves? No, we cannot. Not when we have the means and power to transform Deathlands into a mirror image of Tirawa.
Despite his growing doubt and suspicion, Ryan couldn't help but feel sympathy for Joe's burning passion. It was a wonderful dream. To turn the clock back, to transform the horror of this world into an Eden, and vanquish all the demons spawned by the Skydark.
Shishoka and the Wolf Soldiers do not agree with your ambition?
Not in practice. We used to talk about it, she and I, at night. Shishoka believes that the energies are holy, the life source, the heart of Grandmother Earth. To manipulate them, even for a good cause, is arrogance, blasphemy. She fears that mortals cannot hope to command such power without incurring devastating results.
The cure might be worse than the disease.
Yes, such is her fear. I maintain that this valley is living evidence the energies can be manipulated successfully, beneficially.
This crazy talk, give me the creeps.
So, what do you want us to do, Joe? Go over to the lair of the wolf soldiers and kill them all, the ones on two and four legs both?
I don't want to exterminate them. Simply that they must allow the cavern keepers to fulfill our purpose and duties in the ancient vow to Abadatea. However, I'm not ruling out any course of action.
So let's talk tactics. How much of this valley do you cavern keepers hold?
Only this southern quarter and a few other places near the river.
How long have you been at war?
We've been observing an armed truce, at least until last night. But now blood has been spilled, and that means they're willing to kill to prevent us from entering the cavern. That means we must do the same. Shishoka must have followed me to Amicus to block my attempt to recruit you. She failed when she failed to kill you, Ochinae, and they failed last night. Now, though I regret it, open warfare begins.
How many people live in this valley?
Little over 1,000. My faction is in the minority. Only my blaster tipped the scales and allowed us to drive away the wolf soldiers and occupy the city. However, we can't put more than 300 warriors into the field. The wolf soldiers not only outnumber us in manpower, they have an equal number of wolves as allies.
Pretty stiff odds. But if you drove them away with one blaster, we could easily raise hell with ours.
If the wolf soldiers have only bows and arrows and knives and spears...
And fangs and claws...
Then we should be able to adjust their advantage in numbers. No one has blasters at all?
No, except for my rifle. Tiratwa is firearm free.
Then the best tactic is a frontal assault under the cover of night. Hose our firepower around, make a lot of noise. Maybe scare them off without a great loss of life.
Our warriors might not follow you if you stage a direct attack so near to the cavern. They're afraid of Shishoka.
Why?
As the daughter of a guardian, even one who hasn't been initiated, she is suspected of being a warden of the power in the cavern. That's a superstition, of course.
How can we lead a campaign for you when your own people are controlled by superstition?
Oh, let's lead this triple-stew place. Fuck the gold, fuck the cave!
The best strategy is to capture Shishoka.
You don't want her chilled?
You're warriors, not assassins. If that's what I wanted, I could have done it long ago. Besides, killing her would so infuriate the wolf soldiers, they would never recognize my claim, even if they were defeated in fair battle. No, I think a few of us should penetrate their lair by night and seize Shishoka. Her wolf would lead us secretly and safely to her.
Putting our trust in a wolf flies in the face of the lessons of folklore. What would be the creature's inducement to cooperate?
Freeing him from bondage, of course. The wolves prefer death to captivity.
We empathize. But it sounds like a complicated plan. Dangerous as hell, too.
Yes, but if it's successful, it would clear the way to returning peace to the valley. And maybe restoring a planet. Turning deathlands into lifelands. It seems impossible. But it's worth a shot.
Sunlight mottled the canopy of tree branches overhead. Ryan and Christy strolled hand in hand between the gargantuan columns of the forest city. The diffused sunshine was a pale, comforting green. The nearby river sent them wafts of cool, crisp air.
So, do you believe Joe's story?
Well, let's put it this way. Some sort of power made all this. In all of Mildred's and Doc's stories of pre-dark marvels, I never heard of anything that could compare to this artistry.
They began to walk again, thinking similar thoughts. Though the bloodshed in Amicus was still fresh in their memories, it was difficult to believe that a similar slaughter might happen here. Under other circumstances, Ryan would have had no misgivings, no hesitation about smashing hard at the heart of their enemies, with every bit of firepower they could muster. But here, in the Valley of Tirawa, spilling blood and taking lives seemed so blasphemous as to be evil. The valley wasn't a dream, and everything about it had been created to offer a world without want, without need. Ryan slipped his arm around Christy, and she leaned her head on his shoulder. He reached down to unfasten the top button of her shirt. Then the second. She was intoxicating, and his arms encircled her, bringing his lips down to hers. Her hands stroked his back, the pressure of those fingers arousing. Then she reached for his belt. Part of Ryan knew he should be planning, scheming, preparing for a wreck. But here, in Eden with Christy, time had no meaning. They could follow their hearts, their desires, whenever they wanted, and there would be no consequences. Hastily, they peeled each other's clothes off. It had been a long time since they had had the privacy to make love, an even longer time since Ryan had felt so clean, so young, and so full of hope. They embraced, devouring each other, trails of fire on their bodies from hands roving and fondling. Christy pushed her full breasts against Ryan's chest, desire-hard nipples pressing against the muscular hardness. Slowly, she slipped beneath his encircling arms, dropping down before him. Her mouth was eager, her lips soft, and her tongue warm. Ryan rested his fingers atop her head, and flaming tendrils of hair curled and coiled around his fingers. He gently disengaged himself from her, stepping back and lowering himself to the ground. Christy stretched out on the grass, arms upflung, and opened her ivory legs. His lips moved over her, touching and exploring with his tongue. Her limbs were still trembling when Ryan shifted his weight above her, supported by his arms. He carefully thrust down, and Christy arched her back and hips eagerly to meet him. Both of them shuddered at the sensation. Eyes locked, they undulated against each other. Christy's long legs hugged Ryan's hips to keep him firmly seated within her as they rocked toward a fast, almost frantic rhythm. The green-hued sunlight cast shifting bars of shadow across Christy's face. It was a face Ryan loved, not simply because it was beautiful, but because it mirrored a beautiful spirit. Grabbing his shoulders, fingernails biting into his flesh, Christy raised her head toward him.
Shining times, lover.
Shining times.
Then Ryan gritted his teeth as Christy writhed and bucked beneath him. Ryan lay atop her, their heartbeats racing. It was a moment to savor in this perfect place, one that might not be repeated.
Oh, bunkum and bosh. Fairy tales in modern dress.
Well, if anybody in this room has doubts about quantum physics, it shouldn't be you. Quantum physics dragged your scrawny ass across two centuries.
Whoa, what's going on?
Well, Millie's trying to make scientific sense out of Joe's babble. Her techno bullshit got on Doc's nerves. Can't say as I blame him.
Techno bullshit? Don't hold me responsible for your poverty of comprehension, John.
Or mine. Dr. Wyeth is spinning an entirely theoretical fable regarding the scientific foundation for Joe's mythography about the so-called Cavern of Creation.
Was the totality concept, which spun off over Project Whisper, Project Cerberus, and Operation Kronos, and the Mattrans gateways, just theoretical? If we apply the insights of quantum mechanics to the mystery of this valley, then we can reach a sound hypothesis of how it was formed and created.
Ryan repressed a smile. Because of her scientific background, Mildred continually tried to make some sort of sense out of the warped world in which she had awakened. Most of the time, her theorizing made absolutely no difference about anything, especially her dissertations about genetics to explain the various human and animal muti strains roaming Deathlands. Still, there was no denying that her expertise in medicine and cryonics had saved all their lives at one time or another.
All right, let's hear it. What's your hypothesis, Mildred?
All right. The universe was formed from an explosion of gases, plasma, and matter. It was known as the Big Bang Theory. For the sake of discussion, let's assume a collection of those energies exists on Earth in a temporal pocket or packet fueled by the beginnings of the universe when it was still a primal monoblock.
Monoblock?
The essential building blocks of the universe are no more than ripples in the quantum field. Everything, even hard matter, is stable patterns of these ripples. On a subatomic scale, what appears to be a vacuum is really vibrating and shifting with particle and wavicle energy fluctuations. For example, A single cubic centimeter of space can theoretically contain the hard matter energy equivalent of a 30 megaton nuclear bomb. This is the quantum stream, which exists on a different plane of reality than our own reality. The scientists of the totality concept knew this, and with the aid of technology, managed to tap into it. All the spin-off researchers of the totality concept use the stream as a transit network between the physical here and there. That's basically how the gateways work, up to and including time trawling.
So what does all that have to do with what Joe said?
Well, it stands to reason that if the quantum stream can be tapped into, there should be any number of arteries branching off from the primary flow. If whatever is in the cavern is a naturally occurring artery of the quantum stream, then perhaps it contains the energies released in the first picoseconds following the Big Bang. Channeling the matrix of protoparticles that swirled throughout the universe before physical laws fully stabilized.
You've lost me again.
Me too. Though, this theory never really found me.
If Joe is speaking the truth as he knows it, this energy packet may exist slightly out of phase with this dimension, with our space-time, just like many subatomic particles. The cavern may be an interphase and an interface point between our reality and another.
Granting that all you say may possess a subatomic particle of truth, how does all of that account for the tree city and the crystalline structures?
Oh, that's the easy part. Thousands of years ago, the first humans who lived here, Joe's ancestors, learned how to manipulate the energies to build all of this. Maybe not on a truly conscious level, but through what was known as a probability wave function. A theorem that states that any two particles that have once been in contact continue to influence each other. In other words, Joe's ancestors, the observers of this energy packet, created their own branching probability, their own reality. I wouldn't be a bit surprised to learn that close contact with the energy packet enhanced the latent psychic powers of the mind. That may explain the intelligent animals, too.
As one of my scientist warders at Project Kronos was wont to implore, bottom line it for me.
If my hypothesis has any foundation, then we may be able to manipulate the energies in the cavern to help ourselves. Maybe even return you to your own time period.
Impossible.
No. Utilizing and manipulating quantum energies brought you here, Doc, with the use of technological interfaces to tap into the stream. If the same kind of energy interface exists in the cavern, a natural packet, then the possibilities are endless.
And Joe's plan to reshape the planet? Is that possible, too?
I don't see why not. Of course, the downside, which this Shishoka woman fears, may be just as valid.
In what way?
If these energies are as potent as Joe claims, and if their effects can be influenced, even determined by force of will, then they may run wild. An apocalypse could be triggered that would make the nuke cost in the sky dark look like a 4th of July celebration.
And that is a risk I'm willing to take.
The live Lakota stepped just inside the doorway, his arms folded across his chest.
I brought Bloodsniffer back to the crystal chamber. Come with me, Ochine. There is no need for the rest of you.
Ryan exchanged searching looks with his friends. Doc's eyes were clouded as he thought about the past, and now a possible way to return to it, to his family. That was his dream. In the crystal-encrusted room, Little Mountain brought in the wolf, the leash taut around its neck. The animal swept Ryan with its gaze. Once again, he felt an uncanny chill upon looking into those bright, cold eyes. Joe gave Ryan a golden disc-studded wafer, a twin to the one in his right hand.
Use this.
Both men pressed the wafers to their foreheads.
You must choose now to help end this conflict between our people.
The wolf's black lips writhed back from gleaming fangs.
You want nothing more than to rule our people. I will not help you. Kill me now.
I do not wish to kill you. I wish to speak to Shishoka.
Speak to her then.
On my terms, not hers. You can guide a few of us into the camp of the wolf soldiers. Do so, and you will go free.
If I do that, I will be in direct disobedience to the Guardian's orders.
Shishoka is not the Guardian.
She does not have the support of all of Tiratwa.
Nor do you.
True. Therefore, you will not be disobeying a guardian's orders. There is no treachery in this act.
The animal's eyes widened. The simple logic seemed unshakable. The wolf glanced back and forth between Joe and Ryan.
You promise not to kill any of my people?
You have my word.
Do I have your word also, Outlander?
If my life is not directly threatened, nor those of my friends, you also have my word.
That is well. I give you my promise to guide you safely and secretly to my lair.
Very well.
Joe gestured to Little Mountain, who led the great wolf away.
Good. Now we have a chance.
Don't underestimate Bloodsniffer's cunning and resolution, nor his devotion to Shishoka. He intends to lead us inside the borders of his encampment, then turn on us and give the alarm.
Then why the fuck are we dealing with him?
An intelligent animal he may be, but he's still only an animal. We can outguess him before he betrays us. However, we need to develop a contingency plan in case we're captured. It's tactically foolish for all of your people to accompany us, since their weapons are required to either stage an assault or a rescue. Choose only one of your companions to come with you.
I don't command an army. I'll ask for a volunteer.
Have it your way, Ochinae.
The velvety night brooded over Tirawa. The crystal discs entwined in the tree limbs of the forest city caught and reflected a thousandfold the stars burning the blue-black sky. Ryan turned from the window and looked across the torchlit room at his friends.
The moon won't be full tonight. With luck, we can get in and out before sunrise.
I wish you weren't going. It feels wrong.
It does to me, too.
So it comes down to a volunteer. Only one.
I go. Bunch of bullshit, but should be fun.
I'm not sure if you would be the best for this mission, Jack.
Why? Are you?
Heavens, no. But your, shall I say, pigmentation is not suited for a nighttime mission of stealth.
Hey, what are you...
He's right, Jack. I'll go. This will be like old times with Trader Ryan, just with more, you know, talking animals.
Exactly. And if we can capture Shishoka, we have a chance to clean up this trouble without a lot of bloodletting.
Okay, but you watch that wolf. It'd have your heart in its belly if it gets a chance.
What happens if you're the ones who are captured?
Huh. Maybe Joe has more of those sender gadgets. We'll leave one with you, Christy, since you're the most sensitive.
You don't know the range on those things.
Well, they're not radios. Thought transmissions don't have range limitations like radio waves.
Joe and Little Mountain entered in warrior regalia, with beaded buckskins and faces painted black. Little Mountain carried a tomahawk, a knife, a bow, and a full quiver of arrows. The Gewehr automatic rifle was cradled in Joe's arms. He held a pair of the golden wafers in one hand.
If you're ready, we'll fetch Bloodsniffer. Take these senders. You too must have them on you constantly.
Can you spare one for me?
Are you Ryan's volunteer?
I am.
I have only three. One for me, the others for Ochinae and Mr. Dix here. The closer we come to the wolf soldier's lair, the more silence is essential.
Well, then give mine to Christy. I usually know what Ryan's thinking anyway.
If you insist. Come, we must go now.
Christy, I'll try contacting you at midnight.
I'll be waiting.
After quick embraces between the two couples, the two men followed the Lakota. They walked outside, where the tethered Bloodsniffer stood between a pair of guards. It glanced up at them with its inscrutable eyes. A guard handed the leash to Joe, and the animal limped cooperatively into a compound where warriors waited with five horses.
We're taking an extra mount for Shishoka.
The horses tossed their heads when they caught the wolf scent, but they calmed quickly. Ryan picked a bay mare. All of the horses were dark in color, except for Joe's Pinto. Ryan had left behind the Steyr, since this was to be a close-in stealth operation, hopefully with a minimum of gunplay. Little Mountain, Ryan, JB, and Joe rode out of the compound, on through the silent, shadowed windings of the forest city. The wolf trotted at the end of the leash, beside Joe's steed. When they were out of the city, and on the rolling sward, Joe put the wafer of metal to his head. He spoke aloud in English for the benefit of Ryan and JB.
Lead the way, Bloodsniffer. And remember, if you break your word and play us wrongly, you will die.
Reaching down, he slipped the leash over the animal's neck. The wolf slid ahead, still favoring his hind leg, trotting almost due north. The wolf veered constantly to keep always as near as possible to the stands and groves of trees that dotted the plain. It occurred to Ryan that the beast might be leading them into an ambush, but he learned that the reason for Bloodsniffer's strange route was exactly the opposite. Just ahead of them, the wolf spun, its eyes flashing a warning.
Into the trees, quickly!
There was a stand of birch close ahead. They heeled their mounts into the little copse. The wolf hunkered down in front of Joe's pony, staring intently through the curtain of underbrush. Ryan followed its gaze and glimpsed three gray shadows gliding low over the plain. They were wolves, creeping toward the forest city. After a minute, Bloodsniffer stood.
They go to spy on us.
They left the grove of trees and rode on, continually changing course to keep near the infrequent wooded clumps and rises in the valley's floor. They topped one rise and saw a solid forest wall looming before them. The trees were tall, the spaces between them dark and quiet. It looked like the haunted forests Ryan had read about as a child, full of mystery, gloom, witches, and trolls. They had traveled a little less than an hour in the woods when Joe stopped.
Use your sender from now on. We must stay quiet.
Bloodsniffer looked up at Joe. The Lakota pressed the metal wafer to his forehead, and Ryan did the same.
We must leave the horses here. Too many of the wolf soldiers are about, and we'll catch their scent.
The three men dismounted. Using sign language, Joe ordered Little Mountain to remain behind with their mounts. Bloodsniffer led them up the crest of a sparsely treed slope, then northward along it, pausing often to sniff the wind. He led them down the face of the slope to a fire-scarred break in the trees and stopped, muzzle pointing downward. Below the slope was a curve in the river, and beside the waterway on the opposite side of it glimmered the lights of the wolf soldier encampment. A massive log, embedded deeply in the soft banks of the river, stretched across the watercourse. The bark had long been worn away by human and animal feet. Bonfires burned brightly between the conical teepees. The camp sprawled before and below them like rows upon rows of hide-covered church steeples. The teepees were arranged in two loose concentric circles, one surrounding the other. The smell of cooking meat was carried to them by the breeze. To one side of the village, Ryan saw a herd of hobbled horses, and on the other were racks that bore stretching hides. Figures came and went past the fires, into the shelters, and out of them. Not all the figures were human. Men, women, children, and wolves walked together across the encampment, mingling, jostling, trotting. At a quick count, Ryan estimated that there were an equal number of animals and people. Surveying the terrain, he saw a slight incline that rose about an eighth of a mile beyond the outer circle of teepees. The incline butted up against the base of a rocky mountain rampart. Tumbles of stones, some bigger than the teepees, reared out of the earth. Torchlight flared at the outer border of the outcropping, and men in wolfskins patrolled the perimeter. Between the gargantuan boulders, Ryan glimpsed an opening. He could see it easily, because light shimmered from it. A vague, unreal, quivering glow. The glow throbbed, a ghostly light, pulsing with an eerie phosphorescence. Ryan discovered that if he focused his vision directly on it, the light seemed to fade, becoming like a faintly luminous mist. He could see it clearly, only if he cast his eye away from it slightly. Joe followed his gaze, put the sender to his head, and indicated that Ryan should do the same.
That is the entrance to the cavern. The light is only the feeble outer glow from the cavern core deep within. It was never guarded until recently. Shishoka's doing.
Ryan felt a sharp wonder. The pulsing light indicated a powerful energy, maybe exactly of the type Mildred had theorized. And even if it wasn't, it was still powerful enough to have inspired awe and fear for countless generations. He was reminded of an old pre-dark metaphor, lightning in a bottle. If Joe's tale was only partially true, then he was actually looking at creation in a bottle.
I see Shishoka's lodge, but we cannot enter the camp openly.
So I see. What other way is there?
At the base of the hill, there are a series of tunnels and passages running adjacent, but not connected to the cavern. I have never been in them, but...
Then how will we keep from becoming lost?
We must rely on Bloodsniffer to guide us.
Ryan glanced over at the wolf. It cocked its head at him. He didn't care for the prospect, but unless they took the wolf's way in, they might as well give up the whole attempt to seize Shishoka.
We'll try it. JB, we're gonna go in. The wolf will lead us. You can stay here if you want. Wouldn't blame you.
Hell no, I'm going.
The wolf slunk down the forested slope on a circuitous route away from the encampment and led them into a gully that opened up on a shallow ford at the river. The water was barely hip deep, and the pebble-spotted hump of a sandbar thrust up from the surface at the midway point. The opposite bank was cut by a small stream bed debouching from the river. It was almost dry at that time of year, the high banks hiding the encampment from them as they approached it at an oblique angle. They moved down the stream bed in close single file, treading on the muddy, rocky ground as carefully and as quietly as they could. Their path ended at a dark cleft, wide and tall enough for a human to enter. The wolf paused before the maw-like opening. Then it crept into the darkness. Joe, Ryan, and JB, weapons in hand, followed.